It's so great to be here, and that is impossible to follow. I don't quite know how to transition from what we just experienced together and what now, unfortunately, I think lies ahead of us. But really enjoyed that. I plan on taking some of these ministry tactics to my men's group. Bro, your skin is so smooth. Smells good too. It really is a joy to be here and to be with all of you. I've had a really enjoyable time, even just getting to know your church since I received the invite, and your commitment to one another, your commitment to life with Jesus is really something I've picked up even in my time, exploring your website, listening to a few of your pastor's sermons, and even being here. But we are going to talk about not just politics, but the way that our public life is shaping us, shaping our kids, and the way that the kind of people we are informs the kind of public life we have. Religion and politics are the two topics you're not supposed to discuss at the dinner table. Of course, that's what I've been invited here to speak about. Have you ever stopped to ask yourself why? It wasn't until recently I came to think that the saying is generally true, but for opposing reasons. People don't want to talk about politics because they hold their views too tightly. Too much of their identity is staked in politics. People don't want to talk about religion because they are haunted by the idea that they do not stake their lives in the spiritual things enough, that God takes up too little space in their life. In his essay, Membership, C.S. Lewis writes, "A sick society must think much about politics, as a sick man must think much about his digestion. However, if either comes to regard it as the natural food of the mind, if either forgets that we think of such things only in order to be able to think of something else, then what was undertaken for the sake of health has become itself a new and deadly disease. Our culture and many people in our churches are sick with that new and deadly disease. Politics is causing great spiritual harm in America. This spiritual harm is reflected most clearly in our national anxiety. The American Psychological Association found in response to recent elections that 52% of Americans are feeling additional stress due to our presidential elections. The APA had to develop a term for it. They called it election stress disorder. I don't know if any of you would self-diagnose with that. And they recommended steps people could take for relief. Turn off cable news. Teachers reported students were fearful about the election outcome, even to the extent that they were having nightmares about it. Political campaigns understand and feed into this emotional pull of politics. Increasingly, political messages are not about policies. Instead, the policies proposed on the campaign trail are about sending a message, propping up a desired narrative. Our politics is both driven by and guided by and guiding our emotions. The influence of political tactics is not confined to campaign dynamics. It affects how we are formed as people. Political polarization is at an all-time high. Instead of our values influencing our politics, our political circumstances are shaping our values. As partisans, we explain away the flaws of the candidate we support, and we buy nearly any outlandish theory about the candidates we oppose. We even change what we believe to fit the moment. And there was a survey out of Stanford in 2014 that showed, in the 1960s, when parents were asked, who would you be uncomfortable with your child marrying? In the 1960s, the answer was, I would not want my child to marry someone of a different religion. I would not want my child to marry someone of a different race. Same question was asked in 2014. The top answer, if you were a Republican, you didn't want your child to marry a Democrat. If you were a Democrat, you didn't want your child to marry a Republican. Think about what that means Obviously, the implications are pretty clear for our politics. We see it sort of in our public life today. But think about what it means for basic life, social cohesion, for how families are hanging together, for the kind of burden kids feel under that, for the kind of tension that raises in the family dynamic, that politics has taken up this kind of space. At the end of 2020, about 16 social scientists who are leaders in their fields released a new paradigm of polarization in this country. And they sort of dismiss arguments about whether the polarization we have now is worse than it's ever been. Like they said, that's not really what we want to contend. What we do want to contend is that polarization is different now than it used to be. And the way that they defined it was through a framework called political sectarianism. And political sectarianism is held up by three pillars. The first is an aversion, so a spirit of aversion towards others, a spirit of antagonism towards others. The second is othering, so you exclude and outcast people not like yourself. And then the third is what they call moralism. I call misplaced moralism. I'm okay with people being moralists about things that are moral. I think it's when they're moralists about in ways where that is misplaced. Does Christianity have anything to offer as we think about aversion, othering, and misplaced moralism? Politics is causing great spiritual harm in Americans' lives, and a big reason for that is Americans are going to politics to have their spiritual needs met. This is the meaning of rising polarization, the cause of our zero-sum mentality. Politics does a poor job of meeting spiritual needs, but if it will get your vote, politicians will attempt to fill the spiritual void nonetheless. Our politics can only cause such spiritual harm because our national life has become so spiritually vacuous. What we must recognize if we are to properly diagnose and treat that which ails our politics is that the state of our politics is a reflection of the state of our souls. Politicians can only manipulate those most personal parts of ourselves, our longings, our loves, our hurts, our passions, our hatreds, for their purposes, because we make these things available for their use. The problem is not that we take politics too seriously, but that we take politics seriously in all of the wrong ways. Of course, Christians have been as complicit as anyone else in the state of our politics, and for Christians, the problem is not so much that there are broad swaths of Christians who make exceptionally bad contributions to our politics, but rather that for many, there is nothing exceptional about their politics at all. We are so often driven by the same self-interested, self-protecting motives as other voters. We are so often prone to the same partisan rationalizations, the same politics of contempt as our political opponents, whoever they are. And so a reasonable question to ask then, a question many Christians are asking, is why should we even care about politics? Knowing that politics has the risk of exposing such weaknesses in us, knowing that politics has the capacity for causing such harm, isn't withdrawal the best option? Shouldn't we focus our attention elsewhere? We can draw on many places in Scripture and in the Christian tradition that would help us understand how our faith pushes us toward the public. But let's talk about Jeremiah's message to the exiles. These people, God's people, found themselves in a land that was not their own among a people who despised them. Yet Jeremiah's prophecy to them did not suggest that they lie low or that they take a posture of opposition toward the Babylonians. No, instead they are instructed to, quote, seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I have carried you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, you too will prosper. For Christians, one inescapable conclusion of this extraordinary command is that we are obliged to work for the benefit and flourishing of all people, whether or not they see the world as we do or agree with us in any way. Christians' obligation is not to their tribe, but to their God, a God who cares deeply for all people. And if a Christian's political ideas and actions are not intended toward the good of their enemies, their political witness is not Christian in its character. When it is, everybody benefits. When Jesus came centuries later, he ushered in a new era of good news for all people, not just as individuals, but for the world. Near the beginning of his ministry, Jesus shocked and angered those in the Nazarene synagogue by reading from the prophet Isaiah, "The Spirit of the Lord is on me, because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, to set the oppressed free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." The meaning of this is as clear as it is revolutionary. Jesus came to redeem not just souls, but all things. And the new life that he has welcomed us into is not to be lived in isolation from others. Jesus' commission to the public square can be found in Matthew 5, where he says this: where he says to his disciples, you are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. Christians care about politics because we care about our neighbors and our communities. And political decisions impact our neighbors' well-being. As a citizen, you do not choose to have political influence. You already have it. Therefore, sitting out of politics does not absolve you of blame for the state of our politics. Your sitting out is your choice about how to steward the responsibility you have been given. Faithfulness is not confined to any one sphere of life. It may look different in different arenas, but faithfulness is for all of life. A holistic pursuit of justice and the well-being of our neighbors is inconceivable without political involvement. Politics is one of the essential forums in which we can love our neighbor. And yet, this is not how many of our neighbors view Christians in politics. It's not how many Christians view politics. Why is that? Well, I believe at its heart, it's not a problem of a broken political system, though we certainly have that. It's not the fault of outside forces, as unhelpful as many of them can be. At its core, our politics has exposed a crisis of discipleship. In the introduction to The Great Omission, Dallas Willard observes that, quote, there is a great deal of disappointment expressed today about the character and the effects of Christian people, about Christian institutions, and at least by implication, about the Christian faith and understanding of reality. Most of the disappointment comes from Christians themselves who find that what they profess just isn't working, not for themselves, nor, so far as they can see, for those around them. Willard wrote elsewhere that we have been through a period when the dominant theology simply had nothing to do with discipleship. It had to do with proper belief, with God seeing to it that individuals did not go to the bad place, but to the good place. But that happened in such a way that the predominant thought is that a person can have the worst character possible and still get into the good place if he believed the right thing. This disconnection became increasingly burdensome to the church itself until we came to the point that, as is widely discussed, there is not a clear difference between Christians and those who are not Christians. End quote. For Christians, this discontentment with reality, I think, largely comes from a very personal place. The lingering feeling that we can't quite shake, that while we've said the prayer and go to church when we can, that this really can't be all that there is. That we really can't be all that we are meant to be. For Christians who face this kind of discontentment, and many do not for many different reasons, but for those who do face it, it is because we know that we are not Christian enough, that we are not transformed enough. It's worth pointing out that for many non-Christians, their discontentment with Christians very much shares the same root. And they find in our public life confirmation of that truth. That Christians seem to them as much a part of the problem to our social and political ills as part of the solution. You might notice, though, that quite often when people are complaining about Christians, their complaint is that they are hypocrites, that they do not live up to the example of the one they claim to follow. These people, Willard writes, often beat Christians with their own stick, criticizing them in terms Jesus himself provides. Willard continued, there is an obvious great disparity between, on the one hand, the hope for life expressed in Jesus, found real in the Bible, and in many shining examples from among his followers, and on the other hand, the actual day-to-day behavior, inner life, and social presence of most of those who now profess adherence to him. This great disparity, Willard argues, is a result of the loss of discipleship into the kind of life Jesus lived and that he offers to us. Willard describes this life as life flowing from, quote, an interactive relationship with God and his special son, Jesus, within the abiding ambience of the Holy Spirit. Eternal life is the kingdom walk, where in seamless unity we do justice, love kindness, walk carefully with our God. We learn to walk this way through apprenticeship to Jesus. At the very heart of what ails us as a people and as a nation is a failure to trust Jesus, a failure to apprentice ourselves to Jesus for the purpose of becoming more like him. This matter of discipleship in the end is not really a choice. We will be discipled by something or somebody. Our affections will be directed. They are never really aimless. And it is into this vacuum created by the Great Commission that, among other things, politics has become one of the primary disciplers of our day. The state of our politics is a reflection of the state of our souls. This is the harsh but essential fact of our form of government at bottom. Parker Palmer, a writer, has written that we have a politics of the brokenhearted. We have a politics of the brokenhearted. And part of what that means for me and what I've become convinced of after more than a decade in politics is that while we can and should pursue all kinds of structural reforms that can improve the way our politics functions, the sureness of our aim will be determined by the kind of people we are, by our affections. If we do not truly love our neighbors, if we do not actually want for our political actions to be good for them, we cannot hope to achieve political reforms which are truly good for our neighbors. It will simply not be what we are pursuing. We do not have a loving politics right now. The social science is clear. Howard Thurman, who was a mystic and a theologian who was really one of King's primary influences, aside from King's father, described hatred as tied to ill will. And Willard, drawing on Augustine, defines love as to will the good of another. Political sectarianism is a state in which we hate our opponents so much we'll do harm to ourselves in our interests before we concede anything to them. We push back on a politics of hatred, of ill will, when we decide to place all we do under the jurisdiction of love. Our public activity is oriented toward willing the good of others. There is no 10-point policy plan to instantiate this. There is no tax rate or minimum wage hike which equals love. In his book, The Divine Conspiracy, Dallas Willard talks about barcode Christianity, by which he means that just as at a grocery store, a scanner responds to a barcode regardless of the content of the package. Have you ever been grocery shopping and the barcode has been on the wrong package or on the wrong ingredient and it reads sort of the wrong thing? He says this is basically the approach that many have had to Christianity, that regardless of the content of the package it's placed on, popular Christian messages convey that to be a Christian, to have one's sins forgiven, to go to heaven, one only needs to have undergone the proper ritual, assented to the right creed, or associate with the right group or institution. Willard writes that according to this kind of theology, quote, life now being lived has no necessary connection with being a Christian as long as the barcode does its job. There is a connection, I believe, between this sort of atrophied vision of what it means to be a Christian and a Christian politics, which essentially boils down to a stated preference on a narrow set of issues. Such a shriveled political vision flows quite naturally from the barcode vision of what it means to be a Christian. But time and time again, we find in the scriptures and in our experience of Jesus today that the Christian life is not about a set of positions, but about the kind of people we are becoming. And so I'll close with a story. Robert Coles was a renowned child psychologist, taught at Harvard for many years. He wrote a book in 1986 with the title The Moral Life of Children. And in the book, he describes his theories about why children behave the way they do. He talks about the id and the ego and the superego, how they interact with one another. And yet his theories were confounded by one little girl, Ruby Bridges. At age 6, Ruby was the black student who initiated school desegregation in New Orleans. For months, Ruby was escorted by federal marshals as she made her way to her local public school. For much of the time, she would attend school by herself as white families boycotted and would not send their children to school with a black student. Every day, federal marshals would escort Ruby through a mob of angry people who would curse Ruby, threaten her. Ruby's family was threatened too. Coles recounts, quote, still Ruby persisted, and so did her parents. Coles writes that while Ruby, quote, appeared strong, soon enough she'd show signs of psychological wear and tear. Coles considered a number of theories for why Ruby was acting in the way that she was. Why would this six-year-old girl endure such circumstances? And he floats out a number of theories, theories of denial, theories of reaction formation. But Coles came upon an interesting bit of information from one of the teachers at the school who reported that she was, quote, standing in the classroom looking out the window, and I saw Ruby coming down the street with the federal marshals on both sides of her. The crowd was there shouting as usual. A woman spat at Ruby but missed. Ruby smiled at her. A man shook his fist at her. Ruby smiled at him. Then she walked up the stairs and she stopped and turned around and smiled one more time. You know what she told one of the marshals? She told him she prays for those people, the ones in the mob, every night before she goes to sleep. Colt had to follow up on this. He had been interested in how Ruby slept as an indicator of her psychological state, but he hadn't thought to inquire as to what she did right before she went to sleep. And so he asked her about her prayers. He recounts, Ruby was cheerful and matter-of-fact, if terse in her reply. Yes, I do pray for them. Coles asked her why, and she replied, because. He writes, I waited for more, but to no effect. I've gotten answers like that from my girls. Usually not about praying, though. Coles writes, I waited for more, but to no effect. I started over, told her I was curious about why she would want to pray for people who were so unswervingly nasty to her. She said, I go to church every Sunday, and we're told to pray for everyone, even the bad people, and so I do. And she had no more to say on that score. Coles continues, when I finally began to take notice of Ruby's church-going activities and those of her parents, I'm afraid I was not very responsive to what I heard and saw. I kept wanting to fit what I was learning into what I had already learned in order to say yes once more to the psychological theory I'd acquired before going south. Ruby was picking up phrases, admonitions, and statements ritually expressed, bits and pieces of sermons emotionally delivered, and using all of that in a gesture of obedience. She was being psychologically imitative. She did what she was told, but did she understand what she was doing? She was scared, vulnerable, limited cognitively, grasping at straws. Coles continued to press bridges so he could continue with his analysis, and Ruby told him, they keep coming and saying the bad words, but my mama says they'll get tired after a while, and then they'll stop coming. They'll stay home. The minister came to our house, and he said the same thing, and not to worry, and I don't. The minister said God is watching, and he won't forget, because he never does. The minister says if I forgive the people and smile at them and pray for them, God will keep a good eye on everything, and he'll be our protection. And here Coles thought he sensed doubt in her voice. And so he asked her if she believed the minister. And Bridges replied, oh, yes. I'm sure God knows what's happening. He's got a lot to worry about. But there is bad trouble here, and he can't help but notice. He may not rush to do anything, not right away. But there will come a day like you hear in church. So Coles continued his psychological analysis, but couldn't make too much headway with his existing theories. Coles' wife, he writes, was skeptical as well, but not like him toward Ruby and the family, but at, quote, the kind of inquiry I seemed determined to make. The more, this is in Coles' voice, the more I tried to understand the emotional conflicts, the underlying motivations, the projections and displacements, the more I emphasized the automatic or reflexive behavior of the children we knew, a consequence of their short lives, their lack of education, their limited cognitive development, the more I read and commented on various developmental points of view, which emphasized stages and phases and periods, the more my wife kept pointing to the actions of Ruby Bridges, the deeds she managed. Might we actually have confidence that faith in Jesus is actually viable in all of life. That it's not just for bedtime prayers, but actually it's the bedtime prayers that we can take with us into the world. I would suggest to you that for the great importance of our political debates today, and there are some which are truly important, the health of our politics rests finally and most assuredly not on any sweeping set of policy commitments. In order to have the kind of politics we need, we must become the kind of people our politics needs and help others in that pursuit on our way. Thank you very much. Yeah.